You are listening to The News Project, in studio. Brought to you by GNAT TV.
Hello and welcome to another edition of GNAT TV's in-depth series. I'm Andrew McKeever, the news director at GNAT TV's News Project, and it's a pleasure to be with you today on Thursday, October 7th. It's also a great pleasure to be joined in our virtual studio by Annette Smith, who is the executive director of Vermonters for a Clean Environment, a nonprofit organization that's based up the road in Danby. Founded in 1999, the Vermonters for a Clean Environment is a statewide nonprofit corporation that believes Vermont's economic growth depends on its environmental health and also that the state's future lies in conserving its clean, rural, and small town environment. And Annette has lived off the grid in Danby for 34 years now, and in 2016 was named the Burlington Free Press's Vermonter of the Year. And that's something that's certainly noteworthy. I've certainly never gotten that honor, and I doubt that I will.
They're not doing it anymore, so yes. I'm in the group with Peter Miller and Bill McKibben and Mary Powell and some very noteworthy people, but it was quite a surprise. So thank you, Andrew, for having me on to talk about whatever we want to talk about today.
Well, great. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to form the Vermonters for a Clean Environment and what drew you to energy and environmental issues back in the beginning?
Well, I guess I'd consider myself an unintentional activist and advocate. My background is that I'm from central Pennsylvania, and in fact, an hour south of me where I was born is Three Mile Island. To the north is heavily fracked now, and to the east is coal region. And I probably would still be living there if my family hadn't picked up and left and moved to Sarasota, Florida when I was 7 years old, where I saw the power of the bulldozer. And in 1964, we lived on Siesta Key. It was pristine. The tallest building was two stories. And what I watched happen to that environment in 10 years, I think had a big effect on what I do now. I went to New College in Sarasota, Florida for 2 years, and then the college was sold to the state university system. Half my class transferred out. I went to Vassar College, where I majored and graduated in European history. And my interest in history was primarily to give me perspective. And it was also because a professor identified that I had very good research capabilities. And so I consider myself primarily a researcher. However, after that, I was a harpsichord maker, made wooden products and garden furniture, like the copper furniture I'm sitting in now I made. And I made a whole line of teddy bears that we marketed in Manchester, wooden purses that we sold at the Manchester Frog Hollow Gallery. And I was doing a small farming. I hand milk a cow, which I've done for 30 some years, all descended from the same cow I bought out of the Vermont News Guide in 1987. And I have a big garden, which I'm sitting in the middle of. And so that was my goal, was to be sort of, there's no such thing as self-sufficient because you're always dependent on others for every, you know, for life and being a part of a community, but trying to earn an honest living and not make a big impact on the earth. And then along came this $1 billion natural gas power plant and pipeline project that was proposed for our region, both Bennington and Rutland counties, which hardly anyone remembers now. But it was a big deal in 1999. And I quite literally crawled out of the woods, totally against my nature. I was terrified of public speaking. My friend said, Annette, what are you doing? This is not what we know you to be. But it was like somebody had to do it. Somebody had to speak up and say, this is wrong for Vermont. This is the wrong direction. My first letter to the editor in the paper, the Rutland Herald, was about solar is the right solution for Vermont. And by that time, I had been living off-grid with solar for about 12 years. So I it turns out that I have a very good head for energy issues. And I was researching everything I could and trying to understand why anybody wanted to build a 1,080 megawatt power plant in Rutland and 270 megawatt in Bennington. And it was more than the state used, and the state hadn't deregulated, so they couldn't buy the power anyway. The utilities had long-term contracts. What was this all about? And so then I found out the gas guys, as I call them, were going out to all the towns. And so I went to the select boards, and one after another after another, they opposed the project. I think there was only one that supported it, and they eventually reversed their position. There were town-wide votes that were in many cases unanimous. I think Manchester might have been unanimously opposed. Sunderland was, Tynemouth was. So it was a big fight, and I literally did it thinking, well, my cow is dry, and in 2 months I'm going to get my life back. And instead, Omya came to town in Danby and proposed at right around the same time, about a year later, that they wanted to open a huge mine a mile from my house. And I told everyone, I'm not taking on Omya. And I sort of got drafted into it. And then that took 4 years and 9 months. And they finally pulled out. And in the meantime, I've worked with citizens around the state on landfills, quarries, large farms. I think that the central theme in the work that I've been doing is to assist community members and neighbors in having a voice in what goes on in their community, and taking on inappropriate large-scale development for Vermont. So in 2009, I was asked to get involved in industrial wind, which I'd managed to avoid for several years. And boy, what a nightmare that was. And it really chewed up my life for many years. And it really died down until very recently. Well, now there's a proposal for one industrial wind turbine on Grandpa's Knob in Castleton that has just surfaced and is already doing what we know industrial wind does, which is to stir up people, divide communities, and create a climate of societal anxiety, which I think we're already living in. And so it's a very challenging time to try and do the sorts of things that one needs to do to have a community discussion. You can't hold public forums the way you could. You can't like invite people to watch a movie. There are all kinds of limitations in this online format, and people are very stressed already. So, and then solar started to take off, and I started to assist people in participating in the Public Utility Commission process, which is when I was brought under criminal investigation by the Attorney General's office. A complaint was filed by a lawyer alleging that I was practicing law without a license for assisting people in participating in Act 250 or in the Public Utility Commission, which is what I'd been doing. I mean, lawyers laughed about it. They said, Annette, this is what you've been doing your whole career anyway. I help people with Act 250, with Agency of Natural Resources permits. But the PUC is a very legalistic process, and I wasn't representing anybody. I wasn't doing fee for service. And it's an incredibly daunting process. So that's what ultimately led to the Vermonter of the Year. The Burlington Free Press noted that I was helping give people a voice, and that they acknowledged that I was effective. That was the point. And the renewable energy developers kind of looked like fools. Five newspapers wrote editorials supporting me. Green Mountain Power came out supporting me. Bill McKibben came out supporting me. Aaron Brockovich. I mean, it was quite a riot. And for someone who really doesn't look for publicity, boy, did I get a lot of publicity. But I prefer to do my work sort of in the background and just help people do what they need to do to protect the Vermont that we all know and love, while also trying to move forward with positive things that are beneficial in our society.
It sounds like you've gone on a bit of a journey away from advocating for solar and wind energy as being ways for the state to transition over away from fossil fuels to renewable energy. And I guess I just wondered, is that perception accurate or?
Not really.
Where do you stand now on those kinds of renewables?
Well, I guess the first answer is that Vermonters for a Clean Environment tends to respond to people who need assistance. And frankly, there are a lot of poorly proposed renewable energy projects. Now, of the thousands and thousands of CPGs that the PUC has issued for solar, we've only gotten involved in a handful of them. And so, the idea that I'm working against renewable energy is a wrong perception. However, when bad projects come along, when neighbors have no idea how to protect their interests or participate in the public utility process, then I help them have a voice. Four projects that I have vetted and determined are worth doing that with. And like I said, there's not a lot of them that fall into that category. However, in the context of trying to do positive work, what I have been promoting for at least 6 years is to use a collaborative process, a community-based process, because right now what we've got with the renewable energy development is a developer-driven process. And this is not to blame the developers. They're kind of stuck in the middle of this construct that the legislature set up. And when this first started to get going, the legislation was set up to encourage building renewables. It didn't really matter where, just build, build, build. And so it was the developers and the utilities that set the policies. And in my view, we've done it completely backwards. And so we've seen a lot of poorly sited projects. Wind is the biggest sort of example, because we have this huge problem now up in the Northeast Kingdom with too much generation built in an area with too little load. And so let's learn from our mistakes. And one of the big lessons over the last 15 years has been build close to load, build next to where the power is being used. And there are also lessons to be learned about aesthetics and about what triggers Vermonters. At one point, I did a PowerPoint for our class at Vermont Law School called Good Solar and Bad Solar, over which I made absolutely no judgment. All I did was collect photos, and it was to go through and have the students discuss, is this good solar or bad solar? And one site I thought was good solar, the professor had good reasons to say it's bad solar. So it was a very educational process that I think the students really appreciated. And one of the things we learn is that people really don't like when it's in your face, when it's too close to roads, when it's too close to houses. They like it screened. But then there are all these other issues that are cropping up more and more. The utilities have been telling the PUC, which has been holding regular forums, informal discussions with people who participate with them that have been really interesting. And they are frustrated now because we basically built so much solar that it declines in value. And so it matters where it's built. But when I see towns, energy committees, planning commissions trying to write energy plans, the utilities aren't a part of it. And I think that that's a big problem. And then the developers are kind of stuck with whatever has come up, but they also have to find leases or buy land, and they really ought to be at the table too and have a more comprehensive discussion about really where does it make sense. And I don't know how you make a decision like that without the utilities involved. So I think our whole process is backwards and upside down. And I look at renewable energy based on my experience, where you look at how the system works. And so I have solar panels, I have batteries. I don't have Tesla wall batteries because there's a voltage issue and it doesn't fit with my system. So I have lead acid batteries, deep cycle marine batteries. And then I have a backup generator, which is right now gasoline, but it's also been propane. That's the missing piece, in my opinion. I mean, batteries, I think we need better batteries, but I think that the piece of this that is the biggest challenge in this transition is that we have many periods in the winter where I've got to run that gasoline generator. If I had an electric vehicle, I would be running a gasoline generator to charge the battery in winter. And the same thing goes for air source heat pumps, where I see people say, well, I went solar, and so now I have an air source heat pump. Well, at night, you're not powering your air source heat pump with solar. And in fact, in my system, I would never have anything with a fan that runs all night the way those do. And so when you actually look at renewable energy systems and you think about scaling up from a system like mine, as opposed to trying to scale down from the big grid, I'm trying to get the sun out of the picture. The challenge is that as my career started, we have this dependence on natural gas in the grid. And so some of these hottest summer days, the sunny summer days, we've had 75% natural gas in the grid. And that's primarily what people are running on at night. They're running on grid power, regardless of the contracts. I mean, that's a whole other complicated part of the way that we've set up the energy policies, which led me in 2018 to write a white paper on Vermont's energy policies, because I felt like people did not understand. I would hear like the 350 Vermont people, the kids saying, all we need to do is, you know, meet our policy goals. Well, our policy goals enable all these gimmicks where for instance, the industrial wind projects, again, they're a very good example. None of those are being used to meet Vermont goals. All of the renewable energy credits are sold out of state. And then a lot of Green Mountain Power's electricity is contracted with Hydro-Quebec and with Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant. And then they use some grid power. And so there's this, I call it gimmicks. There are all these gimmicks that were being used that these utilities, Vermont Electric Co-op, Washington Electric Co-op, Burlington Electric Department, GMP, most of them are claiming 100% renewable, or they're going to be 100% renewable. Whereas I think that the popular impression is that we're getting that from real renewable energy, which is not happening. And so, I mean, and then there are arguments about, or shall we say discussions about, for instance, McNeil Biomass and Reigate and the accounting that's done that allows those plants that are basically burning trees to create electricity to be considered renewable when and zero emissions when in fact biomass plants produce more emissions than coal. So it's all a very sort of convoluted scheme that we've got. How do we get to what I think Vermonters want, what I expected we would be doing when I wrote that letter to the editor in 1999, was how do we serve Vermont's communities with renewable energy? And that leads us into a completely different direction than what we have now. You know, the Public Utility Commission has a contested case process. It starts out as a fight. Why do we want to fight? Most people want this, but the whole system is set up to be very expensive and to create a situation where, you know, everybody seems to come out feeling rather bitter about it because of the expense involved. And so I have done successful stakeholder processes. We did end up in a stakeholder process with OMIA, which was remarkably productive. The company itself goes around telling people, you made us a better company, which shocked me that they were saying that. The neighbors used to get yelled at when they would call and complain about air pollution. Oh, there's no air pollution. Well, now if there's air pollution, OMIA takes care of it right away. They're not angry. They're responsive. If there's a blast that goes off that damages something, they repair it. It really makes a difference. Most recently, we were at the table with Agrimark. They have a big problem in Cabot over the disposition of their wash water from the cheese plant. And a group of us came together after a public hearing over their Agency of Natural Resources permit that people, if they had rotten tomatoes, would have been throwing. And it changes everything when you actually sit down at the table. And if I must say, no offense to lawyers, but if you can get the lawyers out of the room, that makes a big difference, because lawyers generally run up their bills, which is another problem I see with the PUC process.
What would you like to be seeing that you're not seeing in terms of how solar or there are very few wind developments that I'm aware of happening. The one that you mentioned up there in Castleton is one of the few, I think, going on currently.
It's the only one going on. And it's a great example of how to do it wrong. So that one is getting, or probably already has, a standard offer contract. And these standard offer contracts, the program itself, is intended for projects that are, to put it in a different sort of terminology, shovel ready. In other words, you don't bid into the process unless you have a project that you believe is ready to build after you submit your petition for the CPG. And there's case precedent and orders from the PUC and the Department of Public Service just weighed in on a case where a standard offer contract was being asked to be moved due to neighbor opposition. And the department correctly cited the cases that came before where the PUC said, you need to do your outreach with the neighbors before you submit your bid for the contract. And that's what this developer, David Blittersdorf, did not do. Now he's going around to towns and saying, oh, we want to talk to you for the next X months. And there happen to be towns that have already dealt with a wind project. They're heartsick that they have to do this again. The four town plans, or even I think there are maybe five, but at least four of them say no industrial wind up on that ridgeline. And the regional plan says no to it. But yet this developer is pushing it through, and that's the wrong way to do it. This is the shove it down your throat attitude. Then there's the other problem that we saw recently with the Richville Road Solar Project, where the developer courted the town boards, but the neighbors were left out. And then the application gets filed, even though the neighbors went to the town boards and felt like they weren't listened to. Then they don't know how to participate in the PUC process. And it turns into, you know, people who should be working together instead fighting. And so in that case, I think the developer needed to include the neighbors in not these heated town board discussions. And you know, our reliance on town government at this time is somewhat challenging. I mean, my town refuses to hold remote select board meetings. They won't hold a public meeting about what to do with the ARPA funds. Every town is different. And then towns are stressed too right now. So how to do this in a way that creates a collaborative process? I think we need a whole new model. And I think the standard offer program's run its course. We're seeing a lot of issues with net metering. And so I'm suggesting a process that changes the dynamic so that the developers aren't the ones that are necessarily deciding the sites on their own and then going to the utilities and saying, will it work here? And then going to the towns and saying, okay, what do you think of this? But rather something that brings everybody to the table. And for years, I've also been advocating that we move siting from the PUC to Act 250. I mean, I've seen thousands of dollars spent at the PUC just to decide where to plant trees. I mean, this is just stupid. And Act 250 already has in statute the ability to hold informal discussions. So making use of the infrastructure of Act 250, bringing all the stakeholders to the table, Act 250 does a good job of identifying that. And first, let's sit down and talk before fighting. I mean, this is such a radical idea, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really off the wall. You had an opinion piece published recently in the Bennington Banner where you say that the Climate Council would be wise to include asking the legislature to modify the Global Warming Solutions Act, the piece of legislation that was passed last year. I wonder if you could explain kind of what you think would be wise to include in the Global Warming Solutions Act, and just sort of in general, how do you feel the work of the Climate Council has been so far?
They've had a lot of meetings, hours and hours and hours. I could spend 2 hours this afternoon, and I could spend another 2 hours later this afternoon, and probably will. The Climate Council's only mandate in the legislation is emissions reduction. And there are some council members who are reminding their fellow councilors of that right now. And if you are aware of Vermont's emissions compared to the rest of the country or compared to the world, we have very, very small. I think we're second only to Washington, D.C. in terms of the actual emissions. So reducing emissions by itself is very, very difficult because it requires huge change in vehicles and heating and, frankly, technologies that I don't think are quite ready. When you have electric vehicles that are catching fire in people's driveway, I think that is a worry. And so Chris Campany, the executive director of the Wind and Regional Commission, I think said it best. at one meeting, kind of out of frustration. He said, we could reduce our emissions to zero and I would still be dealing with all of these flooding events. In southern Vermont, Reedsboro, they're getting 5-inch storms regularly. And these are resulting in a lot of infrastructure issues. And so by having the only mandate be emissions reductions, it is detracting from the other things. I mean, this is a huge, massive topic, and there's tension between the Ag and Ecosystem Subcommittee, the Rural Resilience Subcommittee, and then there's the Science and Data and Cross-Sector Mitigation Subcommittee, and those two different sets of committees, one's mostly focused on accounting emissions and coming up with technologies to reduce emissions, whereas these other subcommittees working on rural resilience and ecosystems don't feel like they're getting equal play in the legislation as it's been written. And how to fix that and what we really need to be doing, I mean, I do think these subcommittees will be coming up with ideas, but they won't carry any weight compared to the emissions reductions part. So I do think it's appropriate to ask the legislation to make them on equal terms.
What is your feeling about a carbon tax?
For Vermont, there's no point. We're too small a state. The carbon tax issue is one that, again, is sort of a gimmick. I mean, I like to follow the guidance of the Indigenous Environmental Network, which has put out some very good policy and position papers against carbon taxes, but their proposal is keep it in the ground. No new extraction. We need to shut down the extraction. I mean, okay, if you tax what's coming out of the ground, then use that money for something else. It enables a lot of gimmicks. And when you actually look at what's happened with like carbon taxes and offsets and things, it's really hard to account for what's really happening. I mean, what's happening with the REC sales of our renewable projects, those can go to Massachusetts to enable more pollution. So we really need to look at what we're doing. Our society is overheated in so many ways that is affecting our planet. We need to scale down. We need to stay home. We need less capitalism. We need to stop this growth model and take care of ourselves in a way that is healthy. And everything we're doing right now in society that's all about growth and build is just wrong, even if it's renewables, because there are all of these other externalized things. If we were to do what the so-called plan is for building out renewables, massive increases in mining, and my work on mining is certainly well informed, what that means for lithium, for copper, for rare earths, all of this technology depends on fossil fuels. So you're just going to need more of it. And I don't know. Why can't people stay home? Why can't they travel less? Why does everybody always have to go look for ways to build more things? Why don't we use what we have and set aside part of the earth for nature? We also have a huge biodiversity crisis. And so I think that there are a lot of people who are feeling this way, but the money people are hooked on this capitalism model that is essentially making a lot of money for people at the expense of our planet. And before we go look at tax policies and things like that, that are just going to enhance the growth model, I think we really need to take a look at how to change behavior. Scale down, a sunny day today. Okay, I'm doing laundry because the sun's out. If it's cloudy for a while, I wait for my solar hot water to heat up and then I take a shower. I don't take a shower using the propane first thing in the morning. Behavioral changes, taking personal responsibility, but also challenging the whole business model of food production, pharmaceuticals. It's all backwards and upside down. And if we don't chill, if we don't scale back, well, what's the next phase? Is that there's ice core history that shows that after warming, you can transform to an ice age pretty quickly. And the Gulf Stream and the streams between the Europe and the United States are shutting down. That's already happening. So while everybody's worried about global warming, maybe we ought to be looking at a rapid cooling possibility too. So it's a much more complicated topic than just reducing CO2 emissions. And that's something that I, in my work, am regularly reminded about, that there's so much pollution going on. CO2 by itself is a one piece of it, but the whole rest of it has been sort of set aside as we are only looking at CO2. And I think that's a big mistake.
Thank you again, Ms.
Well, thank you very much for the conversation. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.